On Wednesday, June 15, 2016, Reverend Johannes Jacobsy, priest of the Antiochian Archdiocese of America, delivered a lecture entitled The Economic Thought of Sergei Bulgakov. This lecture focuses on the economic thought of Russian philosopher Sergei Bulgakov, who lived from 1871 to 1944, and examines his concept of house economy as the means for managing life and society. The lecture was delivered at DeVos Place in downtown Grand Rapids, Michigan, as part of Acton University 2016. Here now with his address is Reverend Johannes Jacobsy.
The period in which Sergei Bulgakov came of age is called the Silver Age in Russian history. That ran from the last decade of the 9th century at the death of Alexander II and the rise of Nicholas I into the first decade of the 20th, when it was cut short by the Bolshevik Revolution. So it was an age of great and astonishing intellectual ferment. Socially and politically, the Silver Age was when the Russian revolutionary currents, the same currents Dostoevsky warned against, especially in The Brothers Karamazov, if you've ever read that book, developed into movements of revolutionary extremism. If you're familiar with the book, it's a phenomenal book, you got to read it. The whole world's got to read it. Because if you comprehend it and understand it, you'll see it speaks to our age today, to 2016, excuse me. These movements were characterized by an unyielding devotion to positivism, a philosophical system that holds that every rationally justifiable assertion can be scientifically verified or is capable of logical or mathematical proof, and that therefore rejects metaphysics and theism. Materialism versus theism. Metaphysics, whatever you want to call it. It was there, it's here today. One movement was, of course, Marxism, the idea that economics and history could be understood as chiefly a scientific, by which is meant materialistic enterprise. We're going to get into philosophy here a little bit, because it's really important we understand it, because this is what Bulgakov wrote against. Materialists embrace only the material dimension of existence and consequently reject the non-material, the metaphysical, the theist, the spiritual, whatever you want to call it. Some thinkers, however, became disillusioned with the positive emphasis dominant at the time and often crude and often vulgar interpretations of man and culture that the truncated materialist vision required and imposed on society. Materialism is very crude. It's very crude when you look at it. Sergei Bulgakov was among them, and as such, his professional life became emblematic of a new spiritual course that is being re-examined today in Russia as it recovers its pre-Soviet identity, but also, interestingly, in the West, as more people realize, and as Solzhenitsyn warned us 4 decades ago, is infected with the same materialist outlook that afflicted Russia and led to its suffering. Sergei Bulgakov was born in Lviv, Russia in 1871, the son of a Russian Orthodox priest. He was raised in an intensely devout family, but at age 15 underwent a deep crisis of faith, largely under the influence of German idealism, and he left his religious faith and enrolled in a public gymnasium. This was a crisis of really quite profound proportion. He left his faith altogether. In this sense, his life mirrored many of the young men who left religion in order to embrace radical politics. He attended law school at Moscow University, where he studied political economy, graduating in 1894 at 23 years old. He's brilliant, by the way. Bulgakov is brilliant. It was during his university education when Bulgakov first embraced Marxism and rose quickly as a leader within the intelligentsia, espousing Marxist theory and dogma. He focused on the economics of agricultural production And while he accepted the notion of capitalist evolution taught by Marx, he began to see that Marxist categories did not work in this field. This is where his doubts began. It should be added that these doubts arose as Bulgakov began to study the writings of Dostoevsky, Leo Tolstoy, and the poetry of Vladimir Solovyov in earnest. He's a hardcore Marxist, is what happened. After his rejection of faith, Marxism is a counter-religion, essentially, is what it is, and he embraced it. This is before, you know, the brutality, the crudity, the just kind of almost the bloodthirstiness of Marxist dogma, which is, I know that's kind of an inflammatory phrase, but it is, and it unleashes a terrible evil, was known, before all this was known. So you had this utopian promise, this unveiling of scientific truth applied to economics, applied to society, applied to culture, with a promise of what? Of a new Jerusalem. But people were very seduced by that. Very seduced, because the sufferings around them were real. Especially in Russian society, it always had problems, economic problems. It was primarily agrarian, and it had cycles of feast and famine. And the famines were real. How could they rationalize that? How could they reduce the suffering? And the promise of scientifically applied economic principles, which is what they thought, what Marxists really believed it was actually a very great promise that portended the alleviation of the suffering that people saw around them. That's how they got seduced into this. I use the word seduced because we know where those ideas led. But at the time, they did not know that. And that's what happened. A 2-year trip to Berlin, London, and Paris, also during this period when his doubts began, quelled his revolutionary, Bulgakov's revolutionary fervor. Like many of his Russian counterparts, Bulgakov was disillusioned with European revolutionary politics. European Marxists focused on the individual industrial proletariat, while the Russian economic ideas focused on agriculture. He simply did not believe any longer that the Marxist categories apply to economics at all, at least in ways congruent with the operations of real life. Catherine Eftohoff, in her prelude to Bulgakov's Philosophy of Economy, writes that by the end of the trip, Bulgakov was in a state of extreme spiritual crisis. He has a second crisis, and it's a crisis about his adopted faith, which would be, in this case, Marxism. By 1905, Bulgakov became a professor of political economy at the University of Kiev and the University of Moscow. The revolution of 1905 made a deep impression on Bulgakov, and he began to openly challenge the anthropological and social dogma of the Marxist worldview. He rejects the notion of the individual as an economic unit and the identification of an individual's psychology as the psychology of the class. In one of Bulgakov's essays written during this period, it is titled Karl Marx as a Religious Type. He begins to see this as a religion substitute, basically. He's the first one to bring this out. Okay, let me finish the sentence. Yes, as a religious type. Now this is common. That we see, you hear me talk, well, Marxism is a substitute for religion. I just kind of throw that out here and there. And this is, anybody who studies economics or history seriously knows this. It's indisputable. Marxists don't like it because it reduces them to something they hate, defines them as something they hate. But I don't care. No, it's just true. But he's the one who saw it first. And he saw that this is a counter-religion. It really is. It's written in the economics. It comes forward in the deep structure of the Christian faith. We can go into that in detail later or some other time. But the recognition that that Marxism was indeed a counter-religion of sorts came from Bulgakov. That's my point. Here, Krasenstanchev, a scholar on Bulgakov, argues, here, Bulgakov, many years before it became a fashion among Marxist critics, that the principle of domination over others in Marxist teachers comes from his own disregard of the individual, in both senses, as a philosophical, methodological notion, and as individual friends and foes in the man's turbulent life and political passions. And here, too, we can say in this period that Bulgakov transforms from an economist to a philosopher. This is the period when he publishes The Philosophy of Economy, The World as Household. That's the magnum opus, which we will examine below. The depth of transformation is evident on the last phase of Bulgakov's career that began after the Russian Revolution of 1917. In 1918, Bulgakov was ordained as an Orthodox priest at the Holy Lavra of St. Sergius. He continued his teaching at the University of Simferopol in the Crimea until January of 1923, when he was exiled. From 1924, he fled to Paris and joined the faculty of St. Sergius Theological Institute of Paris, where he remained into his death until 1944. So that's his history. That's his background. When Marx as a religious type came out, Lenin hated it. Lenin was exiled in Zurich at the time and wrote against him. And he could see the shift in Bulgakov. Bulgakov was one of the sharpest thinkers of his age. He was brilliant, 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 right? And he was one of the top Marxist apologists and theorists at the time. So his disillusionment with Marxism, it's more than that. It's a spiritual crisis. It's recognizing the inner structure of this murderous ideology. It's really what it is. Recognizing that and leaving that was a blow to the Marxist establishment. Lenin read a lot of Bulgakov, and then when Marx as a religious type came out, he was basically banished banished. Okay, now we're going to get into his thought, his economic thought. The term, the world as household. The term economy comes from the Greek word oikonomos, which is ekos nomos. Ekos is the old Greek word for house. Nomos is law, measure, rule, implies management. Ekos nomos, economy in English. But how do we understand this, Bulgakov asks his audience. I'm outlining his book, okay, the World as Household. Our time understands, feels, experiences the world as household, Bulgakov says, and human power is measured in terms of wealth. In contrast to the voluntary, involuntary asceticism of Franciscan or the Buddhist epochs of history, which despise wealth and deny its power over man. Our epoch loves wealth. This is Bulgakov talking about his era. Not money. There's a difference between wealth and money. Okay? But specifically wealth, and believes in wealth even more than it believes in the individual. So he's describing his time. At the same time, you can see how he's thinking. Wealth is not a bad thing. Prosperity is not a bad thing. Okay? There's no implied denigration of wealth or prosperity in Bulgakov's thinking. I dare say we see it in much the same way. Bulgakov continues, life is above all an economic process. Such is the axiom of this contemporary economism, expressed in its most extreme and even provocative form as economic materialism. This is why economic materialism has such survival power, combined with the appeal of ideological radicalism. Its sharpness actually increased by the naivete and immediacy. In practice, economics are Marxists, even if they hate Marxism. Okay, what's he mean by that? What he means by that is if the understanding of economics is reduced to only the transaction that takes place between people, we don't understand economics. So, in other words, most people, he's talking about his age, but I think it's true too, most people have a Marxist view of economics, which is to say reduced to just its material properties, the transfer of money. But economics is something much, much more than that, he argues. Bulgakov's reproof rings as true today, I think, as when it did when he first delivered it in 1912. We tend to limit the definition of economics to financial transactions. We don't see much beyond the wealth-creating mechanisms, or even question if any theory of political economy can rise any higher than the mathematical measurement of wealth expressed as money. Is that clear? Is that clear? I mean, yes or no? Okay, it's clear. All right. Because once this is really what opened this up. I have to be honest with you. I was always kind of bored with the discussion of economics. I was always bored with it. Until I read Bulgakov, I'm glad I said yes to it. Because I saw, even in my own thinking, economics was nothing more than the mechanics of the transaction. But reading economics, I realized, no, it's much more than the mechanics of the transaction. Economics describes how we view and how we approach the world. And that's what Bulgakov gets into. And then saying that, having said that, I realize, you know, most people view economics, not just the study of economics, but the study of how things relate in the world, how wealth is created, how wealth is transferred, how a culture lifts itself up, that type of thing. That's fundamentally a question of philosophy, spirituality. It goes deep into the assumptions of how you see the individual and how you understand the individual's relation to the rest of the world and creation. That's what economics is. So most of you guys probably know that. For me, it was a great discovery, and I'm interested in it more than I ever was. Okay, anyway, the truncation... the idea that economics is nothing but kind of the mechanical transaction of the transfer of money, all right, that's the way I define it, is rooted in a materialistic view of creation, that nothing exists except matter. Bulgakov argues in his great work, The Philosophy of Economy, from which I just quoted, seeks to overturn that. Economics cannot be separated from what he calls a larger philosophy of life. He criticizes much of the dominant philosophical thought of the time, particularly Hegel and Kant, accusing of betraying and debasing philosophy, and this is, and as a result, the emergence of the materialistic worldview that results. He writes, this is Bulgakov. Okay. I deny this independence and self-sufficiency of the self-styled absolute spirit which generated both pure nothingness and pure everythingness and equates itself with the Creator. Life is more immediate than and prior to any philosophical reflection or self-reflection. Life cannot be reduced to anything simpler than itself, although it proceeds from the source of life, the God, of the living, but not of the dead. And he continues, if you're following this, these are the strongest rebukes. And I read this thing, man, I love this stuff. Intellectualism, he continues, this is a quote, intellectualism represents an extraordinarily powerful current in contemporary European philosophy and might even be called a hereditary illness that first appeared in its forefather Descartes with his ultra-intellectualist, I think, therefore I am. This Cartesian reduction, still quoting, perverted the... End quote. This Cartesian reduction perverted the philosophical quest, Bulgakov writes, and is one cause why both the confusion about economics, the truncated understanding, and what he calls a hypnotic fascination with materialism exists. Okay, quoting Bulgakov again. Despite all the ambiguity and lack of charity of Descartes' statement as it was developed by Descartes, history has interpreted it in the most intellectualist sense possible, that is, being and ultimately life, as well as the individual personality, require a rational basis and can require it from philosophy. Philosophy is then torn from its roots and inevitably falls into a delusion of grandeur, immersing itself in the world of dreams and shadows, sometimes grand and fascinating, but ultimately lifeless. I mean, he's just blowing the whole tradition out of the water when he says this. You can see here that Bulgakov spares no criticism of materialism in all its manifestations, particularly the hijacking of philosophy. The philosophy of Hegel and Kant and their followers is reduced philosophy, Bulgakov says, to subjective idealism disguised as philosophical reality. Kant, Bulgakov writes, was inspired by the pathos of objectivity and strove to free himself from subjectivism and solipsism, in which he rightly sensed the foul spirit of non-being. But he nevertheless approached this goal by a purely speculative, contemplative path. In order to do this, he killed living reality, transformed it into an image, a schema, before beginning to study its concreteness. He sought life in death. This is Bulgakov writing about Kant. He sought life in death and the sweet smell of the fields in his study. Okay. This is the world in which Bulgakov wrote and the worldview he sought to displace. Put more simply, Bulgakov strove to replace man in his rightful place in creation, to restore the vision of man and creation within the revelation of God in the world. All right. Are you following me on this so far? Is this interesting or is it too deep? Yes.
What book was that quote?
That was from the... The World as Household, the economic philosophy. Okay, now we're a few things left about the guts of his economic analysis. Okay, consumption and production. Economic life, Bulgakov writes, can be reduced to a metabolic process, to something like circulation or inhaling and exhaling. And the economic cycle consists of two acts, production and consumption. We're all familiar with this. For this reason, the general question, how is economy possible, reduces to two or more particular questions, namely, how is production possible? How is consumption possible? Human life, then, indeed all persons, are connected to the cosmos as body. I'm going to use this word cosmos a lot. It's in Orthodox circles, it's very familiar. Cosmos is the entire creation and everything that makes it up. It's a Greek word, you know. It can mean people, and it can mean the entire creation, the entire universe at the same time. Okay, so that's how it's used. He calls us a physical communion of being. Now, this is really, now listen to the next part. The next part is key to his thinking. At the same time, a line runs through the cosmos that divides it into two, what he calls kingdoms, two spheres, two territories. You can use any word you want. The living and the non-living. The kingdom of the living, the kingdom of the non-living. This is the interplay of life and death is a riddle, a mystery, but it nevertheless exists. This so-called life force in creation, trees produce seeds, for example, bodies heal. If you cut yourself, your body will heal the cut. But this is a great mystery. Why is it that your body is directed to heal in the first place? Where does that come from? Why isn't it that when we cut ourselves that you just kind of bleed to death? No, your body heals. Okay, that indicates a direction, that indicates a purpose. Bulgakov says that exists in the very, not matter of creation, but in creation itself, right? That's what he means by the life force. And when you look at creation, you see that creation is really oriented towards bounty, towards healing, towards wholeness. Apple trees produce apples. That apple produces seeds, so it can continue and multiply. All right, so it's a fundamental orientation towards the world. He calls that the life force. This so-called life force in creation means that all of creation is interrelated and possesses at minimum the potential of becoming a living being. Secondly, the death kingdom, or death principle, if you want, gravitates not just towards a succession of life, but towards non-being. Okay, so there's also death in the world. There's death in the world. We know this. We don't have to argue this, right? But the spirit of death is the spirit of dissolution. You've got to go back to the Greek. I'll give you an example from the Greek. Diabolos, the word diabolical comes from there. Diabolos, something that separates. Diabolos, something that separates. See? So what is the spirit behind this separation, behind this fragmentation, behind this deconstruction? Because that's what death is. It's the tearing apart, the breaking down of the unity. Fights against the life force. It's the impulse towards non-being. Follow that? But you cannot enter a state of non-being. You can't. Because God created everything out of nothing. But since God created it, one cannot step outside being created. One cannot step outside of his creation. That includes us, anything that's alive. Stepping outside of his creation is not possible for the created. It's not. We cannot. Non-being does not exist as a choice. Death does. We can kill ourselves. But we cannot enter the place of non-being, which was before the world was created. We're part of the creation. So behind the death, the activity towards death, behind the diabolos, behind the separation and deconstruction, is the impulse and the longing towards non-being. It's irrational, but of course it's irrational. It's non-being, right? And these are the two things that are in conflict in the world. If you follow this, you can see how it's reconciled in the incarnation of Christ. Okay? Because he enters death and destroys it. That's what he came into the world to do. He entered death and destroys it. His resurrection is really the defeat over this kingdom of death. That's why he came. All right. Now I've got 10 minutes left before questions, so I got to finish up. Okay. Economics arises out of these dual energies in the creation. And it all hinges on food. You need to eat to survive. That's where it starts. Your relationship, the individual's relationship with the creation begins with eating, consumption. You need, remember the apple tree? The tree creates apples so you can eat it and so you can survive. There's purpose there. You eat it. Now go back to the Garden of Eden, right? How did the fall occur? It occurred through eating. So it's the need to live, to consume, by which the whole project of economy, all the relationships on earth begin. And that's what the study of economy properly understood, of economics properly understood, really is. So you can see he looks at it in a profoundly theological way. Life is impossible without food. Bulgakov writes, "The skeleton of death stands between us and spurs us on in our search for food. The boundary between living and non-living is actually removed by food. We live because we eat." The world, then, has what Bulgakov calls a flesh. That is, the materiality of creation is necessary for the life of the world, of creation, of cosmos, that itself is honored by God himself when the second person of the Trinity, the pre-incarnate Logos, himself took on the materiality, the flesh of the cosmos that is created and dwelt among us as Jesus. We could take this further and talk about the verse that says, "He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood," John chapter 6, "you have no life in you unless you eat the flesh, and drink the blood of Christ." This is a solid affirmation, then, of the very materiality of creation. So, to say, you know, you go back to the scripture, God looked upon the world that he created, and it was good. It is good. It's still good. It's still good. You need it. It's a positive. We need to eat. We need to eat. Eating keeps us alive. Eating keeps us alive. So the very materiality of the world is good, is blessed by God. It is blessed by God. Now, how do we know this? Because Christ himself became flesh and dwelt among us. Christ himself, the second person of the Trinity, the pre-incarnate Logos, that's what we call him before he revealed himself as Jesus. Okay, what do we call him before that? Well, we're going to call him the pre-incarnate Logos, all right? But took flesh and dwelt among us. In the beginning was the Word, in archi ithan o Logos, in Greek. In the beginning was the Word. The Word there in English is Logos. So in the beginning was the Word. The Word became man and dwelt among us. So he takes on this created materiality himself. He takes it on. And through the womb of the Theotokos, of the Virgin Mary, she gives him his flesh. That's how it worked. She gives him his flesh, all of us here, men and women alike, your body and blood come from your mom, not your dad. All your dad did was give half of the genetic code. And get this, even the sperm cell that carried the code and injected it into the egg, died. There's no physicality from your father at all in any of us. It's all from our mother, all right? It's the mother, Theotokos, Mary, gives it to the Logos. He takes on this flesh and dwells among us. Now, he also, when he's crucified, enters death, destroys death. How do we know that? Because he rose again. All right? But he rises in the flesh. Okay? How do we know this? Because when he revealed himself to the disciples, he ate fish with them. He ate with them, okay? He ate fish. It's a glorified body, the Apostle Paul tells us, but it's still flesh. It's still the material and substance of the creation. So this is good, all right? It's good. The second theme, so the consumption is good. We've established that, right? Say yes. Okay. The second theme of economic life is production. How is production possible? Production is the exertion of the force of a subject on an object of man on nature, such that the object of the economic process imprints or realizes his idea, objectifies his goals on the object of economic action. Production is, first of all, then, Bulgakov writes, a system of objective actions. The subjective here becomes objectified. The boundary between subject and object is removed, and the subject comes out of himself into the object. I'm using his language, I know, and it's so deeply philosophical, but basically what he's saying is this, is that production happens when we act on the material, on matter, on the material of creation. That's what production is. And that production itself reflects the personality of the producer. All right? I'm going to skip this and just explain it. Production occurs when you have a plan and you have matter, wood, metal, whatever it might be. Okay, you might cultivate a garden, you might build a chair. Okay, production occurs when you conceive of what you're going to do. You enter into this world, you take the matter, and you fashion something out of it, whatever it might be. Could be this table, it could be pruning a new tree so that the fruit is better, whatever. It could be sitting down at a computer writing an essay, right? And so in that production, then, there's implied a relationship. There's a relationship between the subject and what is being created. Now, I'm going to jump ahead because time is running short. This relationship is expressed not solely as, you know, a mechanical, the application of force on the nature. It is, right? But it has to be understood as a relationship between the subject, the person, and the object, the nature, so that what is created conforms and comports to this life force towards goodness, wholeness, health, or against the dissolution and the deconstruction. All right? So that's key.
Can we say then, when we look at the statue of David, we see marble, we see David, and we see Michelangelo?
Yes. Yes, and that's, it's beautiful, yes. And you can even go a little farther. Michelangelo, when he saw the marble, already saw David in it and just brought David out. That's it. That's exactly it. And he says that this process and doing it this way is written into the very fabric of the creation. That's what he's saying. And that our relationship to nature has to be understood in precisely this creative dimension, no matter what task we put our hands to. I'm skipping my notes now because I just got this thing on. I've only got 5 minutes, okay? Now, man is created such that he has an obligation towards nature. What is the obligation? Nature finds its created destiny by the cultivation of man. Nature needs to be humanized. Nature itself sees its reflection in the face of man, just as man sees himself in the reflection of the Logos, of Christ. Follow that? That's what's going on here. And that this relationship partakes of salvation in this way. That's the salvation of Christ, because he took on human flesh, was not just a salvation of man and the individual, it was a salvation of the entire creation. Because by taking on flesh, the materiality of creation at the incarnation, it's the entire creation that is elevated. So, did Jesus die for your sins? Yeah. But he died for a whole lot more, too. He died to destroy death. He died to elevate the entire creation and begin the process of recapitulation. That is, bringing it from the Eden back from whence it had fallen back to the kingdom of God, to its original intended purpose. And the kingdom of God and Eden, by the way, are essentially the same place. Okay? So in the world, then, in the world, what operates is a life force. A life force that we cannot see. And here's where he attacks the materialist vision. It's not just about scientific processes. Okay, science reveals the processes of the materialism, of the material, okay? But we cannot reduce it to that. That's the problem. That's truncated materialism that he tore apart, and I read that in the first part of the lecture. But he calls it Sophia, wisdom. Okay, and this life force is a force that guides us in God's recapitulation of the world. So we have a moral obligation to it, but we also, it's not only moral, it's also that we are to learn, as sons of God, what our role is in this creation to affect the recapitulation. We are to live in the world, to actually fight against the death in the world, and bring it into life in the same way that Adam did in the garden as a steward of the creation. The nature of that work changes, of course, but it changes how? In this way. In the Apostle Paul describes it as we learn how to put death to death and live in life. But that living in life is actually participating in the recreation of the world, guided by, well, the Spirit of God, and again, what Bulgakov calls Sophia. I'm not going to go into Sophia in any great detail. It's very controversial. If I were to explain it, and I'm not, I would go to St. Maximus the Confessor instead and talk about the Logi and the Logos.
Acton University is a unique 4-day exploration of the intellectual foundations of a free society presented by the Acton Institute. Acton's mission is to promote a free and virtuous society characterized by individual liberty and sustained by religious principles. For more information on the programs and activities of the Acton Institute, visit our website at www.acton.org.